And that jarring cacophony tells you, yet again, it's the Power of Three podcast. The podcast that's taking a trip through space and time, having exciting adventures on the way, and encountering all of the Doctors. This is the 9th episode in a run. Now, technically, we know we should be featuring a War Doctor adventure, but there's only been one novel so far, and that's one that we've done already, George Mann's Engines of War. So, rather than do a comic book, we're carrying on looking at novels rather than comics. But trust me, we do intend to come back to those in the near future. So today, we're going to be featuring The Monsters Inside, which was, unbelievably, the second novel in the BBC New Series Adventures run. I know, the second seems so long ago. It was written by Stephen Cole and featured the Ninth Doctor and Rose Tyler, and was released on the 19th of May, 2005, with a cover by Henry Stedman. Now, I don't know about you, but when these books were first released, I was shocked to discover that not only were they in hardback, but they were pocket-sized and obviously shorter than the books that we'd been used to during the Wilderness years, if you've been a follower of the New Adventures, the Missing Adventures, the previous Doctor Adventures, or even the Eighth Doctor Adventures. You'd have noticed a significant change, but here they were, lovely little hardback books. And before long, they were here, there, and everywhere you could not escape from Doctor Who. So I got mine as soon as they came out. Unfortunately, with this batch, I cannot remember if I got them in a bookshop or if it was a supermarket, but obviously I got them. So today we're going to be chatting about The Monsters Inside, and if you haven't read it, or heard it in the audiobook version, then probably stop now because there's going to be some spoilers coming up. Is that you back? I hope you enjoyed it. So let's hear what the back cover blurb has to tell us about this book. The TARDIS takes the Ninth Doctor and Rose Tyler to a destination in deep space, Justicia, a prison camp stretched over seven planets where Earth colonies deal with their criminals. While Rose finds herself locked up in a teenage borstal, the Doctor is trapped in a scientific labour camp. Each is determined to find the other, and soon both Rose and the Doctor are risking life and limb to escape in their distinctive lifestyles. But their dangerous plans are complicated by some old enemies. Are these creatures fellow prisoners, as they claim, or staging a takeover for their own sinister purposes? Now, this book was released as an audiobook in November 2007 by the RNIB and read by David Thorpe, and it wasn't until July 2012 it was actually given a formal BBC audio release, and this time it was read by Rose's mum herself, Camille Kadiri, and we're going to hear a little excerpt from that now.
Warder Blank had entered the kitchens, Norris by her side. She stared balefully at Rose and then down at the pulped potato mess over the floor. Wonderful. It couldn't be Riz's mate, Robson, the soft touch, could it? No, not for her. Did you make this mess, Tyler? Asked Blank quietly. Rose looked round at the flushed, surly faces ranged around her. She knew she was going to get done for this, through no fault of her own, but she wasn't a grass. Yeah, she said. Sorry, I must have slipped and knocked them.
You slipped all right, she said. Come with us.
Where to?
Don't question me, Blank barked. Move!
Rose ignored the smirks and the gestures and the mouthed threats as she trailed out of the kitchen after them. At least she was getting out of this particular corner of hell.
Looks like Casda went easy on you last night, Blank observed. You better hope that the governor's feeling is lenient.
The governor? Rose frowned. But I'm due to see him in a few hours anyway.
That was before you screwed up, said Norris. Shame. Never makes a good first impression. You know, being sent to see the big man on a charge before he's even welcomed you. Rose shut her eyes. That's not fair. Last night, you start a fight. This morning, you damn near start a riot in the kitchen block over a few potatoes. Riot? Oh, come off it. Blank turned on her, gripped her by both shoulders. You're a disruptive element, Tyler, she hissed, and I'm going to make sure the governor knows that, ahead of any appeal you might be hoping to make. Rose looked at her unflinchingly. How come you ended up such a bitch? Blank raised her hand to strike Rose, but Norris caught her wrist, shook his head. Blank's eyes flashed, but then she nodded, took a deep breath, calmed down. She seized Rose by the sodden scruff of her neck and marched her forwards down the corridor. Soon, they reached the governor's block. The decor became softer. There were carpets on the floors and decorative plants about the place. Air conditioning whirred softly in the background. A desk stood empty beside them. Where's his assistant? Muttered Blank. There was a rustling noise from further down the corridor. Sir? Called Blank. She propelled Rose ahead of her, Norris following just behind. Sir, I'm sorry to disturb you. But it looked to Rose as if the governor was disturbed already. The heavy oak door to his office was ajar. An eerie blue light sparked and flickered inside, like electricity. A ripe smell of decay wafted out through the door. Sir? Blank frowned. Rose froze. She recognized the light and smell from past times with the doctor. The terrifying memories came rushing back. Blank started forwards, but Rose grabbed hold of her arm. Don't go in there, she said. That's not your governor. What are you talking about? Blank pulled free crossly. You've never even seen the governor. It's a Slitheen, said Rose, backing away. Or from the Slitheen planet, anyway. She felt Norris's slab-like hand settling around her arms. They're evil. Killers. They dress up in human skins. They have a machine that squashes up their bodies, see? And when they unsquash, that light starts up and... Shut her up, growled Blank. She's crazy. Rose struggled in Norris's grip. I'm telling you, your governor's dead, she said desperately. There's a monster in there now, and if we go inside, we could wind up dead too.
So there we go. It is the Slitheen. Who would have thought? Well, not just Slitheen, Blathereen as well. And of course, we'll hear more about them very soon when we chat with Steve Cole, the author. But yes, I remember being very surprised that Slitheen were in it, the fact we were getting a TV monster already in print and getting a sequel to an already on the screen episode. So that was really exciting. And I do remember vividly the imagery of Slitheen hiding inside a sphere to try and escape, which there's something about that just stuck in my head. I don't know what it was, but I rather liked it. It's a good fun book, really enjoyable, and I have to say it's definitely a world away from Orange is the New Black, which of course was to follow a few years later on Netflix. But having reread it recently, I couldn't help but picture Rose in an orange prison uniform and the likes of Badison and various other characters lurking in the background, but probably that's just me. So, without further ado, let's hear from the author.
Hello, I'm Steve Cole. I am the author of The Monsters Inside.
This must have been a real treat, being involved in something that was old yet new, the same but different, and NDA'd up to the eyeballs.
NDA'd in all senses of the acronym. it was a treat, of course, as you say. Having been occasionally writing for the book range, but we'd known that, you know, there were mumblings and rumours of something happening, but of course nothing's safe until it's dead, so you don't really kind of want to believe it until it's happening. And then of course it was happening, and that had the effect of basically bringing to an end the range of books to which I'd given so much, which I'd overseen the starting of. So it was, you know, knowing that that's coming to an end and that a new era was beginning, it was, you know, it was slightly poignant, but also it was very exciting. And because it was all so top secret and nothing was allowed out, it was very, you know, flattering, I suppose, that that when Justin was asked about who to write these first three original novels for the new series, he came to me and to Jack Rayner, who had been working on those books, because, you know, we had form of keeping it all secret and doing our bit, and, you know, I guess we can say doing it well. We were considered safe pairs of hands for that, rather than just getting other authors who, you know, might have been less less ready to stick to the terms of their NDA, because, of course, it was all a brand new thing. No one was expecting it to be quite the massive success that it was. I remember some of the marketing stuff around that time was talking about, you know, oh, it's great for a great nostalgia for lads and dads. You know, that was literally how they were pitching it. And you think they got that so utterly wrong. You know, this was, but people had so many preconceptions of the old series, which is why, of course, there wasn't huge amounts of merchandise, because everyone thought it was going to be quarries and wobbly sets and all the rest of it, no matter how many times Russell insisted that with his stature and size, he would be able to personally prop up the wobbly sets. So there was that feeling of people wanting to see how it went and, you know, what's a fairly reasonably cheap investment is the production of books, of course, because if you do three and they don't take off, well, you haven't had to tool an entire production line of action figures, you haven't had to do a whole ton of merchandise. You know, it's something that you can generate because we've been generating it for some time. So when, of course, the Eccleston series did come back, there were just those three novels with the logos on, and I think some Slitheen walkie-talkies in Woolworths. I think that's about the extent of the merchandise at that time, which was, you know, wonderful, because historically the Doctor Who books still had a royalty, which meant that there was actually money to be had for the first time, writing a tie-in for a successful TV show. So yeah, exciting and happy times.
What do you recall about the initial discussions about who was going to do what? Obviously there was a past, a present and a future.
Yes, well, Jack and Justin and I went to Cardiff to meet with Russell and the script editors, I think. And it was basically kind of decided there who would do what. So Justin was assigned a historical one with the Clockwise Man, and there's lots of talk about him going to the building with Big Ben in and researching that and how exciting that would be. And Jack was given the present day Powell Estate story to do, which would obviously explore Jackie and the gang in print for the first time. And I was asked if I would take Rose to her first alien planet, because of those very you know, silly accusations in advance that Doctor Who would be made in quarries. Russell was very careful to avoid them in the first series, and only do the alien planet in the world of imagination. So I was, yeah, it was what a treat to be able to have that moment where Rose goes out onto her first alien planet. It was an exciting meeting, not least because some of the first rushes came in that very day, and so we watched them with Russell. It was Eccleston greeting the space pig in the corridor, and the nurse there also reacting to the space pig. So I think those are the first, some of the first, if not the first, footage shot. And being able to see Eccleston peer around the corner saying hello to this pig, you suddenly got a real sense of his doctor and what it was like. And I just remember Russell saying how keen he was for these books to be the best they could be, that we'd be working with the script editors also editing, as well as Justin, of course, editing them, and to have a fully integrated thing of program and tie-in fiction, and right there at the beginning of it all, that was possible, which was, you know, hugely exciting.
And then, of course, you got the chance to include a monster off the telly as well.
I did. And, of course, I hadn't seen this monster off the telly at that point. But, yes, Russell asked if I could put the Slitheen in. And I found them. I'd read the scripts of, I think, the first half of the series. I always remember that originally Aliens of London, the second episode, I think, was Die Hard in Downing Street. That was actually written on the front of the script, which I found, like, you know, what a brilliant descriptor for it. But I was fascinated by the way that they weren't just an alien race, they were a family, and that the Slitheen wasn't the alien name, it was the family name. So I suggested a different family in this one from the same species, and came up with the Blatherine, because I thought it sounded quite funny. And Russell then took the Blatherine and kind of put it into some sort of official document of Raxacorica Valapatorian law, and to the point where in the Sarah Jane Adventures later on, Gary Russell assumed that the Blatherine were Russells, and so he put them into one of those. And when I saw it on TV, I was like, oh, that's nice. I said to Gary, oh, thanks for sticking in my monsters. And he goes, I fuck what? I mean, obviously, you know, Dorsky buys out all rights in your creations anyway. So it wasn't like I was thinking, how dare you? It was just really fun. Because, of course, I'd already had canonicity bestowed upon this story by Rose herself in Boomtown, which was very exciting when she referred back to Justicia, or Justicia, as she calls it. I've been corrected on the pronunciation of my own alien planet by a fictional character. This is something that can only happen in Doctor Who. So, yeah, I think it's odd, but because of these two things, The Monsters Inside has become, I think, possibly the most canonical of all the tie-in novels, because it's said to have happened by the character herself.
Which is wonderful. Not things you don't expect when you're starting out.
Well, so, exactly.
So talking of Rose, and indeed the Doctor, how did you find capturing their voices, given that they speak in a very different way from previous Doctors and possibly companions, with the exception of Ace?
Yeah, the whole thing was very different. And that was actually, I found, incredibly refreshing after, you know, paddling in the same pool for a long time. I mean, I love the Eighth Doctor, but he was always a construct back then, a construct of prose. But when you're seeing, obviously, something being brought back to life in such a modern and innovative way, as Russell did with the Eccleston series, it was, just a real treat. I remember there's a scene where the Doctor is talking to Rose he's on one planet and she's on another, and he's kind of giving her clues by talking about the house numbers of characters in EastEnders. And I thought, this is something that you couldn't ever do in any other Doctor Who iteration, which is, very freeing and really good fun. So it was having that heightened casualness about them, the references to pop culture, knowing that you were writing for a different audience to the one that had been consuming the BBC books up to that point, that whole new generation was going to come back on board again, making sure that it was a story that fit not just with older readers, as some of the EDAs had, but to a family audience, just as the show was trying to pick up. I mean, people didn't realise it, but Russell was reinventing the Saturday tea time schedule again. He was part of that. Having Doctor Who was a huge, huge part of drawing families back in front of the TV again in a colossally wonderful way. And of course, the books are trying to do the same thing by appealing on more than one level. So you might have Slitheen and fart jokes for some of the younger ones, but you'd also have a story challenging enough for the good old, the younger teen audience as well and beyond. So it was an interesting line to do, and working with Helen Rayner on The Monsters Inside was very good and very informative too, because she would say when it needed to be more open, less sci-fi in a way, and she sort of picked up on certain things with regard to Rose in particular, and how she would be getting on in the prison and how to approach that. So it was very very stimulating, because suddenly it wasn't just your vision filtered through Justin's editing prism. It was working with the production team, the script editors, and even Russell himself, and obviously conferring with Jack and Justin a lot as well. I think I edited Justin's book for him, because we were just keeping it in the family. So there was a sense of excitement about the whole thing, and I think we both Justin, I and Jack, found that very liberating.
It's quite an adult setting to be in a prison, particularly when you mention at some point there's mention of rapists and also suicide. So there is that sort of darker underbelly there that I suppose that those of us who'd stuck with the Eighth Doctor books sort of had come to expect and know.
I doubt that would get through now, This was, of course, in that transition period from one to the other, where we were made more aware of that. I remember there was a couple of things that were taken out because they didn't quite chime with the feel of the series. This went a little bit, yeah, maybe perhaps a little bit too adult. But, you know, that's kind of the threat of this sort of stuff. I mean, we can look back to The Keys of Marinus to see Doctor Who presenting a rapist. It's the way that you handle it and the way that you try and make a, you know, a situation acceptable, but also add to the fact that, you know, this is a very awful place for Rose to be. It's not fun. I was thinking, in a way, I suppose, in my mind, I wasn't thinking of something uber realistic. I guess it was more like a space version of Prisoner Cell Block H with aliens, which is why it has things like the there are characters in there, like in the doctor's facility, which I think is it one Neshalop or something, isn't she? Look, yes. Like a horse with polka dots or something very silly. And I think things like that were put in to kind of soften some of the rougher edges.
There's a lot of fun in there with the Slitheen as well, and the Blatherin, as getting, particularly with the Slitheen getting to hide inside the globs, which I was most, that was the thing that I most remembered for, came back to rereading this, like Slitheen hiding inside globs in the ducting system.
Which I'd completely forgotten about, so thank you for reminding me. Yes, I think again, it was just trying to do something different, so they're not just repeating themselves. Obviously, I think there is some skin suit stuff going on, isn't there? Or the doctor suspects it, or, but yes, they do something different. And that was, you know, just about, yeah, avoiding retreads really. And when you're reusing a monster, you want to explore other areas and other possibilities, just as Russell did with Boomtown, of course, which is a very different Slitheen story to Aliens of London and World War III.
How did you find putting the humour into the monsters like that? Because that's quite different.
Yes. And the Slitheen work and a very darkly comic, I mean, that silent but deadly line is, you know, a great example of something that's funny and sinister and childish and grown up all at once. But to have a degree of that and to, you know, to indulge in a degree of that is really good fun on the page. Also, because you have, you know, different families, and, you know, so the Slitheen aren't necessarily always the bad guys, even if they're not, they're certainly not the good guys either. They always have plans and schemes, but, you know, it's not just a whole race all thinking the same, all homogenous, you know. I quite like the fact that you can have different types and different factions and, you know, indeed different families. Families never get on.
Yeah. Yes, very aware of that. There's something that I realised last night, and I feel incredibly dumb because I've only worked this out. The monsters inside, obviously, is a title that's referring to the Slitheen, but inside, of course, being prison. And I only realised that last night. So it's only taken me 19 years to get the pun in the title.
Well, Kenny, that's nothing, because I was looking at a Target novelisation from 1977, and I was looking at the Wyndham's logo on the back, and I suddenly thought, wait, that W is two books, part open. Pages in the go- I thought, oh my God, that's like, most of my adult life, I've finally got the Wyndham's logo. I wanted to write a letter to someone just to congratulate myself and congratulating myself. But yes, it is indeed a hilarious pun on that. Much as I'd had with the Gods of the Underworld, which of course was the Underworld in the Benny book series, mm-hmm. with Underworld obviously the dual meaning of criminal underworld and religious one. So I think with a title it's quite fun to do that sometimes. And yeah, it was all good. I remember I was kind of annoyed that we were asked to put like Bad Wolf references in, but we didn't understand why at that point. And I think my Bad Wolf is literally quite a literal big bad wolf is coming, so it feels like that's slight. And if I had my time again, I would probably do something else. But I think it's too late now, sadly. I think it's a little bit too late.
Well, I noticed when I was chatting with Steve Lyons about Time of Your Life, And obviously there's lots of TV stations in the missing adventure. And one of them's called Wolf TV. I like to think it was rebranded soon after the Sixth Doctor departed. So that's just me, my fan brain, making everything match up. But
yeah, you're right. It was probably Clara that did that in one of her multiple iterations.
Exactly.
So it makes perfect sense.
Mm. So how long did you have to write it? Was it quite quick turnaround compared to previous books?
No, I think it wasn't too bad. I think we actually had, I think I remember thinking this was a reasonable amount of time to make it all right. I remember towards the end of the process, we were invited in to watch the rough cuts of the episodes, which was really good. And no decision had been taken on the theme music yet. So they just played, they were topped and tailed with the Tom Baker opening credits, but only the start of it, which then ran backwards before Tom Baker's face appeared. And then it was that music. So it was amazing to have this very new and modern thing, but with Doctor Who's opening titles from the 70s over the top. And, it worked very nicely. But yeah, we watched Rose and the Slitheen stories. And that was a very exciting viewing because, of course, it didn't have the right music. It didn't have all the effects. But you can see the absolute potential and thinking, yeah, actually, this is going to be really big. What a treat, because it's so nervous watching it, thinking, because you realize suddenly it comes back to you how much this show means to you and how much you want it to be good. And it wasn't that I doubted that it would be, it's just I didn't realize just how firing on all cylinders right from the start this was going to be. So yeah, very, very exciting. And that kind of just led to I did the rest of the writing and the amendments on a very swift wave of inspiration.
So when the books came out, when did you realise something was different? Very, very different.
Well, the fact that they were in an entirely different format was something. But as I recall, I was also typesetting these books. I'm pretty sure I did, because I remember having to audition various type sizes and had to use... Someone in the art department had bothered to... come up with all these Gallifreyan numerals, which were all obviously very difficult and circular, and I was assured made some kind of sense. But I remember being terrified that I was going to get the wrong number behind the wrong chapter, because of course you wanted to have them in the right order. So that was always a panic. So I suppose the process was different for me right from very early on, knowing that it was going to be obviously a different look, a different format, different type size. It was the beginning of a new era, and I did that first one, but I was also busy at that time. My Astrosaur series had been commissioned and I was busy writing those. So Justin asked if I would write a second one for Eccleston, part of the second batch. But I had to say no, because I was too busy. But when it suddenly burst out and then people were reading the books and kids were talking to me about these books, when I went on school visits and things, when I was offered one of the first David Tennant novels, it was like, yup, doing that. Nothing's going to stop me. Because it was a real, obviously it was a real shot in the arm to the whole thing. But it wasn't just back on television, it was back in bookshops and a real big phenomenon again. And, that was the icing on the cake, I think, for me, having worked on a range that was, always loved and a bit of a, cult success. But to then crossover and let the books share in the glory of the TV show, just as they had really with the Targets all that time ago, was terrifically exciting.
I think that I realised that something had changed big style when I saw them for sale in supermarkets, and that's when you realise, wow, this is no longer a case of having to have a standing order in my local Waterstones or Autickers as it was at the time. Yeah. And then when you see them in supermarkets, you think, I don't need to hunt these down. They're virtually selling themselves to me, and think that's when you realise this is big.
Yep, that's right. When the supermarkets wanted to do their own editions, as they did with the little paperbacks we did of the hardbacks a little way down the line, and they're doing packs of 10, you think there's obviously, the fact that they're being sold in tens means that there's this voracious demand for it. And it was happy times, fun times. And great to be allowed to contribute to the books as I did.
But the biggest question of all is, Steve, in terms of continuity, do they go after Aliens of London or do they go after Episode 8?
I think, personally, they go after Aliens of London. Well, after, you know, the Clockwise Man follows Aliens of London, I reckon. And then that. So, in my mind, it was in that earlier spell. But who knows? I could be wrong. I was wrong about how to pronounce the planet. So, you know, don't take my word for anything. Ask Rose. She's the one who seems to know it all.
Absolutely. Good old Justicia. It should be Justicia, but it is Justicia.
So, that's the one.
Yes. Rose knows best, it would seem. So how do you look back on this one now? It's just, there seems to be an awful lot of fondness for it because it was a shot in the arm and you did play your part in New Who.
Yeah, it was lovely. And it was, you know, with when Rose goes out onto that alien planet, that was a nice scene to do. And of course, she finds a flower because that's what Jo finds in Colony in Space when she stands on her first alien planet. So there's a little callback to that moment there. Again, obviously at that point, no idea that, you know, Jo Grant herself would come back to Doctor Who and Sarah Jane. But it was, you know, we were keen to kind of keep a continuity to show that it was all one big series. And I know that was obviously the aim, but we were keeping everything very focused on the new, as we should, of course. But obviously with Series 2, Russell started bringing in elements beyond the Daleks for the show. And yeah, what a ride it's been ever since.
Yeah, the fact that the flower appears in the cover as well. It's just a shame you never called it a Lily on Philadelphicon, but other than that, just for the sheer hell of it, a gorgeous cover as well.
Yes, it's a lovely cover as well. But thinking about it, I think the flower might have been there. Maybe I put the flower in after that, or maybe they just took that because we didn't want to put the Slitheen on, I think, because it was to maintain an element of surprise, at least when you see the cover. Probably mentions it on the back cover, I don't know. But
no mention of them there.
We were keeping it secret. So there were literally monsters inside that you didn't know about.
It's got three meanings.
Three meanings. Now we just have to find another acronym for an NDA and we'll be keeping track of you.
Well, Steve, this has been brilliant. Thank you so much.
Great pleasure, Kenny. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that, Steve. Steve mentioned there that this was a book that got a mention on TV. So let's hear a quick excerpt as Billy Piper chats about the adventures and what takes place in The Monsters Inside as it featured in Boomtown.
Oh, sweet. Look at these two. How come I never get any of that?
Buy me a drink first.
Such hard work.
But worth it.
Did you manage to find it?
There you go.
I can go anywhere now.
I told you you don't need a passport.
It's all very well going to Platform One and Justicia and the Glass Pyramid of San Clean, but what if we end up in Brazil? I might need it. You see, I'm prepared for anything.
Sounds like you're staying then.
And now, as we've been doing throughout this run, it's time to hear what Doctor Who magazine had to say in their contemporary review. And this was written by Matt Michael, friend of the podcast. Matt reviewed the three original novels when they came out in the pages of DWM 358. And here's what he had to say. The Monsters Inside is less strong in atmosphere, but it's funnier and has more energy. If anything, because of the presence of the flatulent Slitheens, it is most like Aliens of London, with a parade of monsters similar to The End of the World, thrown in for good measure. It also puts the Doctor and Rose on alien planets for the first time, although Rose's well-written wonder is short-lived, given that she's locked up almost straight away. With the goriest moments and some slightly more adult themes, especially given the Borstal setting, The Monsters Inside is the raciest of the three novels. At a push, the best by a whisker is The Monsters Inside because it's most successful at balancing the humour and horror and giving equal weighting to both the lead characters. But everyone is a little treasure that can sit proudly alongside a series of unfortunate events on the bookshelf. Brilliant. Not fantastic, Matt. So there we go. That's pretty much what Matt summed up the book as. There was quite a lot more to it, but that's the main part, chatting about this one, rather than The Clockwise Man and Winner Takes All. Anyway, there we have it. If you want to follow us on social media, you can find us on Twitter at PowerOf3Pod. You can find our Facebook page, and you can share your thoughts and let us know what you thought about this book. So, time's running out, and as always, we like to play out with a tune. So, for this one, I've decided to pick a Scottish band, who some of you may remember if you're a fan of the Scottish football on Sky Sports, because this was a track that was used as the main tune for a while. This is, appropriately enough, Inside by Stiltskin. We'll be back tomorrow with the 10th Doctor adventure. Bye!
Because I'm broken.